This is Across Divides, a series of stories and experiences from communities across the island of Ireland as they meet shared challenges and consider opportunities for collaboration. Find out more at icommunityhub.org.
Hello, I'm Alex McMaster, and in today's episode we'll be looking at the biodiversity crisis as an all-island issue. What are the challenges for those who are attempting to address it, and why it necessitates an all-island approach? And I'm joined in the studio this morning by Mark Horton, MBE. Mark is the All-Ireland Director of the Rivers Trust and Chief Executive of the Ballanderry Rivers Trust. I'm also joined by Shirley Clerken. Shirley is the Heritage Officer for Monaghan County Council, an environmental scientist. She studied law in Dublin before working in the NGO sector, including the Irish Wildlife Trust and Antosca. And joining us from Waterford is Una Fitzpatrick. Una is a senior ecologist at the National Biodiversity Data Centre and is responsible for the All-Island Pollinator Plan, as well as the plant and vegetation programmes at the data centre. Thank you, everyone, for joining us this morning. And I think I'd really like to start with you, Una. A lot of people will have heard of the biodiversity crisis and described it in different ways. I wondered if you could give us a bit of an introduction to what it is, and especially in the context of this island, and why we need to take an all-island approach in addressing it.
Thanks, Alex. It's really lovely to be part of this episode. Yeah, so in Ireland, you know, we've got amazing biodiversity. You know, there's over 31,000 different species, really, you know, a gorgeous, amazing range of biodiversity. But the issue is that it's in real crisis. You know, it's disappearing, basically, you know, in front of our eyes, day by day, week by week. It's being eroded. And, you know, we know that the habitats that we have, only about 15% or so are in a good state. Of those species that we've assessed, about 17% are threatened with extinction from the island of Ireland. That, like, those are really frightening numbers. So biodiversity is in difficulty across the entire island. And I suppose the imperative is there to try and come together and do something about that. And, you know, it has to be addressed on an island scale. Biodiversity, you know, it occurs island-wide. And I suppose the advantage is that we can all come together across the entire island to take steps to change that. And often there are simple steps that you can take. And, you know, I can talk about the pollinator plan in a bit. But there are simple steps that we can take to change things for biodiversity. But really, you know, it's so urgent. We have to do something now. It really is disappearing, you know, as we're speaking. So I think, you know, it is a crisis, but we can come together and address it.
Mm-hmm. And your work with the All-Island Pollinator Plan is, I guess, identifying that issue and specifically looking at pollinators. Would you mind telling us a little bit more about that work involves?
Yeah, so within Ireland, a lot of people surprise them. They've got 100 different types of bees. So there's the honeybee that people are very familiar with, that the beekeepers keep in hives, but then there are 99 wild bees. And unfortunately, of those 99, one-third are threatened with extinction from the island of Ireland. So what we've tried to do with the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan is to use pollinators almost as a vehicle to try and help people to engage with the biodiversity crisis. You know, we know biodiversity is in crisis, but it's a bit overwhelming. You know, it's hard to feel empowered to know what you can do about it as individuals. Whereas what we do is use pollinators as that vehicle to sell or to communicate that wider biodiversity message across sectors to a broad swathe of different people. And pollinators are perfect for doing that. You know, most people feel an affection for them, I suppose, to start. A lot of people, you know, like bees. They understand why they're so important. They understand what a really important role they play within our ecosystems in terms of providing pollination service. And also the steps that you can take to protect pollinators are really simple and easy to do. But in taking them, you're not only helping pollinators, you're helping biodiversity generally. And the fourth reason why pollinators are so good is that you can easily monitor changes. So once you start making positive changes within the landscape for pollinators, you can really quickly see the positive impact of that. Yeah. So that's, I suppose, why we use pollinators as sort of as that vehicle to sell this wider biodiversity message. And, you know, within the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan, what we've tried to do is bring people together from right across the whole island. You know, it has a steering group with representatives both from Northern Ireland and from the Republic of Ireland. And we came together to write it, you know, we come together to implement it. And I suppose that's what we've been doing together. And, you know, what we've been trying to do is to make sure really that everyone knows how they can help. And that's been a huge part of the plan, is just identifying these evidence-based actions across all sectors, you know, from councils to communities to businesses to individuals to farmers, so that anyone who wants to help knows what it is that they can do to help, and that we can all do it together and learn together, you know, and move forward together.
I think that, biodiversity, in a sense, is a prime example of an issue that does kind of transgress those boundaries. And I'd just like to come over towards Mark now, because rivers are a prime example of entities that don't necessarily respect the jurisdictions that are, I guess, created by humankind. Could you tell us a little bit about the work that the Rivers Trust have been doing on an all-island basis, and why that is important?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, you're right. Rivers do not recognise boundaries at all. We have rivers that flow from the Republic of Ireland into Northern Ireland, and those that start in Northern Ireland and flow into the Republic of Ireland. And we need to be looking after those rivers at a whole catchment scale. So when the rain falls on the land, it falls into a depression in the land, which we call the catchment, and the water is going to flow to the lowest point that it can get to, and it's going to cross borders. But we're managing rivers slightly differently on each side of the border on the island of Ireland. The Rivers Trust's approach is to engage communities in protecting and improving their own rivers. So we're a very bottom-up organisation where communities identify a problem in their local river. They come together to form a charity, which we call a Rivers Trust, but they can come under any name, really. And those communities identify ways, using their own knowledge about the river environment, to improve that water environment for its species, for its habitats, but also for the communities that depend on our freshwater environments. And very much like what Una was saying, as well as our biodiversity crisis, we have a water crisis in Ireland. There are in the Republic of Ireland, less than half of the rivers are in what we call good ecological status. And in Northern Ireland, it's actually less than 30% of rivers. And I say that because that was the statistic that was issued kind of at the last look at water quality. But there is a more recent assessment that's just been done where in Northern Ireland no rivers are achieving good ecological status, because we're now having to contend with the issue of what we call the forever chemicals. Mm-hmm. So chemicals that get into our watercourses that will just not break down in the environment, and they're there forever, mm-hmm. hence their name. And so we're facing a real crisis where we all depend on fresh water to survive. Our economy, our rural tourism, recreation, all depends on fresh water, and yet we are polluting it hand over fist, and we're taking different approaches to managing it on either side of the border, and we need to come together with an all-island vision for what we want to see happen to the future of our rivers and our freshwater environment.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned those forever chemicals. We've talked before about your project that's addressing specifically one type of chemical, which is in your Source to Tap project. I wondered if you would be able to tell us a little bit more about that, because it is such a wonderful example, similar to what Una was talking about with the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan. It's such a fantastic example of a project that does transgress those kind of jurisdictional boundaries.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. There's a chemical called MCPA, which is in common use in agricultural settings, and it's used to control rushes, because the one thing we're very good at growing on the island of Ireland is rushes. Yeah. With our damp soils and our wet climate. Landowners are almost forced to control the rushes because EU regulations say that if they have too much rush on the land, it's not actually being agricultural productive. Mm. So they use MCPA to control the rushes. It doesn't stay on the land for very long. It gets washed off into rivers. And what we're seeing is a buildup of these chemicals in our freshwater environment that are impacting on things like drinking water supply. Mm-hmm. So a lot of our drinking water, both in Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, is taken directly from our rivers. And these chemicals have to be removed from that water before it can be sent to our taps mm-hmm. to drink. The Rivers Trust is just one partner on this cross-border interreg-funded project. And we've been working together to help landowners make small changes on the farm that can reduce the amount of chemical that's escaping, or indeed the type and amount of chemical that they use to control rushes in the first place. So we've been working with landowners to basically stop their use of MCPA, replace it with a different type of rush control, which is called weed wiping, where you just wipe a very small amount of chemical onto the rushes to kill the rush. Mm-hmm. And we have actually now been able to measure a very significant reduction in the amount of MCPA in the river. That doesn't just benefit the water itself, it benefits the wildlife, it benefits the wider society as a whole, the ability to use those rivers for recreation, but it also reduces the cost that's incurred in cleaning our water for drinking. Mm-hmm. So this has a whole societal benefit. But what's amazing about it is that it's all being achieved by landowners making small changes in farming practice that are also saving them money. Yeah. So it's a win-win benefit for everyone. And this is the type of thing that we need to be identifying right across the island of Ireland in all spheres of environmental management. How can we all get win-wins out of having a healthier environment overall?
Mm-hmm. I think that's something that's becoming really important to recognise whenever we look at issues like biodiversity is that they are intrinsically linked with our livelihoods and our lifestyles, and you know, it's not something that's separate from us. And this project that you're describing, I guess, specifically addresses a divide in the sense that it's working in both jurisdictions of mm-hmm. Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, but it also is looking in a sense at a divide that often seems to exist. I mean, when we talk about sort of conservation and scientists who are working in biodiversity, there's often regarded to be a kind of a conflict between those groups of people and people who are then working on the land, who are farmers or who are fishers or who are kind of making their livelihood on the land.
Yes.
But you have directly been working with those groups of people.
Yes.
And how have you found that experience, and how has it worked, and how have you kind of been so successful in bridging that kind of gap?
Well, I think the first thing to remember is no one wants to see a damaged environment. Everybody mm-hmm. wants to see a more healthy environment for us all to live in. And landowners are, and farmers are often described as the custodians of the landscape. But they also have so many rules and regulations imposed on them. And I think they find it very hard sometimes to know which way to turn, mm-hmm. even for a bit of advice to help them make the right decisions about what they should do on their farms. So an organisation like the Rivers Trust, being a charity, is not a regulatory organisation. We can go on to farms and help them to identify things that could be changed without fear of them getting into trouble or being fined or prosecuted in some way. So it's about having the kind of honest broker, which is what we're acting as, and building trust in the community so that we can have open conversations about how we work together as scientists, as environmentalists, as farmers, as all sections of society, to come together and find the best solutions to manage the environment. Mm-hmm. I think if we have these barriers that you're talking about, where people mm-hmm. fear talking to people, other people in other spheres of knowledge, then we're not going to share the best practice, the learning that's needed amongst all of us to be able to see an enhanced environment on the island of Ireland.
Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of intersectionality is something that's becoming more and more recognised in a whole bunch of different spheres, but it really applies here. And I'd really like to come on to Shirley, because Shirley, you work at the moment as the Heritage Officer in Monaghan County Council, but your work over time has spanned so many different areas, and even at the moment in your current role, you're looking at biodiversity but also at heritage and at archaeology. And I'm just wondering how you kind of manage that intersectionality and why it's important to kind of recognise the links between all these different areas.
Yeah, well, I think it's about sort of getting an idea of your sense of place and your locality, actually, and how you fit into it. Mm. And like Una has, you know, set out the biodiversity stall there very well about the losses that we're facing and how our environmental trends are all going downward, and also what Mark is saying there about working together in a community. And I think when you look at your sense of place and you consider, you know, the landscape, the geology, you know, the archaeology, the sense of communities that have gone before, whomever's lived there. So you're looking at your ring forts, even your townland names, you know, that apply right across this island, how places were named and what they were called. You know, the places are called, you know, the wood on the hill, or the rounded hill with the garlic in it, or, you know, they've got these beautiful wetland names and descriptions. And, like, you know, those places were recognised for their topography and for their biodiversity, you know, by people that have gone before us. Mm-hmm. And people depended very much on their local environment in those times. And heritage officers, we work in the Republic of Ireland, so there's a heritage officer in each local authority. And we work very much on that intersection, as you said, that folding together of biodiversity and cultural heritage, so that you're trying to really get a sense of how everything has worked together to provide livelihoods for people in the past. So how farming started, how settlements actually became, you know, situated in a particular place. Were they beside a river? You know, were they on top of a hill or beside a wetland? And how those places developed over time, how burial rites, funerary rites, you know, how people lived and died in those places. And then how we moved out of those places through our industrial archaeology, our railways, our canals, looking at all of that, and how communities then moved out, how people moved out and communicated with each other and brought back stories and, you know, built that sense of place, that wider sense of place. But now as a heritage officer, we work to build information at that very local level. So we do sort of trying to get baseline surveys together about, you know, what our hedgerows are like in our county, what the state of them are like, for example. So we've just finished a hedgerow survey from Monaghan, which is a repeat survey, which finds that over the last decade, we have, like, our hedgerows have really even gone much worse for their condition and their extent than they were 10 years ago. We, you know, do a lot of wetland surveys, trying to get a handle on the habitat types that we have, the quality of them, whether or not they've been eutrophied or full of nutrients, you know, because the biodiversity crisis is also a pollution crisis that, you know, that Mark has mentioned. It's also a waste crisis. You know, it's a climate crisis, you know, and it's even a social justice crisis, because who's going to be affected the most? Who's going to be able to afford quality food? You know, we're in that entire circular economy. So heritage officers, it may sound like a backward looking term for something, but it actually is all about what we bring into the future. So how we mind something today, how we look after it, who are we thinking about? Are we thinking about the present generations? But we're thinking about the past generations, the present, and how we bring all of that into the future and what we can learn from the past. So that's very much the space that I'm in. Mm-hmm. About biodiversity.
Yeah, and I think that I'd like to come back onto something you mentioned there in a moment. You mentioned, you know, looking back into the past and looking at those baseline surveys and kind of, I'd like to come round onto those kind of goals. And I guess in that sense, when we talk about baselines and we talk about, you know, setting goals in biodiversity work, the data that we gather to contribute towards that, I guess, is we're trying to say, well, what's the condition of our landscape now, and what are we kind of trying to achieve? Where are we trying to head in the future? Are we trying to restore something that existed in the past? Are we trying to go for a new situation that's different from what existed in the past, that's evolving? And I guess, Una, your work is as an ecologist at the National Biodiversity Data Centre, of course, data is key in that sense. And I guess just coming on from what Shirley said about collecting that information on hedgerows, and it applies to so many different ecological systems, I wondered how we kind of, yeah, are able to set those goals and what kind of baselines we actually work from whenever we're setting them.
Yeah, it's a really good question, and I can never stress the importance of data enough and in having those baselines. So, and to be frank, I suppose, you know, across the island, we haven't been particularly good at that in the past. So quite often we're in a situation where we don't fully understand what it is that we've lost, because, you know, we haven't been collecting baseline data, you know, going back. So it really is so important that we do that now, and that we do it into the future, so that we know where we are and that we can set realistic goals. And what you said is really interesting, Alex. You know, are we trying to restore things to the way they used to be? And I suppose it's it's not as simple as that. And perhaps, you know, you need to look at different sectors separately. You know, I always think of farmlands. When you think, you know, of farmland, you know, in the 60s, the 70s, when my mum's from a farm and she was growing up on a farm, you know, it was low intensity. It was really biodiversity friendly. It's not about going back to that. It's about looking at farming now and finding a new balance that works for both nature and works for farmers, you know, and the same thing, you know, with local authority land, you know, it's about finding a balance that works for all the different kind of amenities that are necessary, but that also allows nature back into our lives and all the vital services that it's providing us. So, yeah, I honestly can't stress enough the importance of collecting data and having that data shared across the entire island. You know, we collect data in the Republic within the National Biodiversity Data Centre. And then you have CDAR, you know, who collect data in Northern Ireland, you know, and we share information, and that really is so important. But I suppose what we've been trying to do in more recent times is just to make sure that we are setting up those data streams for the future so that when we have initiatives, I suppose, like the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan, that we can track whether or not it's working. There's no point having a plan and bringing all these people in around it unless you can actually show that you're having a positive impact with it. So, you know, I think, and that's absolutely crucial.
Yeah. Sorry, did you?
No, I think it's the positive, it's really the positive impact that we need to have, but it's the baseline. I think Una's there is talking about the baseline data. And like, that's something we found in Monaghan when we, you know, started work 20 years ago, was that we didn't actually have baseline data at that county level. And we started trying to collect it over time so that then we can see where we are in relative terms from that. So are our hedgerows getting better? Are our wetlands in better condition? Have they more species in them? Are they able to, you know, be, is water quality improved or gone down? And these are all of the ecological services that are provided by our biodiversity. So Mark was talking about water quality there, and it going down over time. But, you know, if we don't collect this information now, we won't be able to track it going forward either. But there's also this idea about this shifting baseline. And because we haven't had good information before, there's been a lot of stuff that we've actually lost track of, and even people's visualization of what the environment looks like and what they expect to see. Mm-hmm. People have lost the idea that places that look wild or maybe unmanaged, shall I put that in inverted commas, are what the environment should look like. It should be green. But green isn't the same as good for the environment. You know, that idea of everything being really, really green across the island, that often means that it's over managed or that there's no biodiversity there. So for farmland in particular, we need to find ways of bringing biodiversity into that overly managed landscape and finding ways where we can bring biodiversity into towns and cities and, you know, really right across the whole island so that, and that everybody can get an idea. Biodiversity is something that they can engage with as well, but something that actually improves their life. And that, but we all need to change our idea of what that looks like. We really do. You know, towns have become overly managed. They've become really manicured. There's no green space, or, you know, no wild space, which is a different thing entirely, you know. So I think that the baseline is essential, but also our understanding of what nature looks like needs to change.
Mm-hmm. And I guess it's a whole huge question of what we can consider to be wild, and what a wild space is, and where that existed in the past or where it still does exist, and as you say, our perceptions of landscape are constantly changing, and it just kind of demonstrates how much landscapes are part of culture.
Yes.
Whereas in the past we've so much kind of drawn that divide between landscape and culture, but as you've described, Shirley, through your work and linking together heritage and ecology in that way, it shows that linkage that exists and that kind of need to recognise that not everything fits in sort of different pockets here and there. And
and
I guess it also comes through what you said, Mark, about how rivers and farmland are so intrinsically linked with one another.
Yeah.
But those are also completely linked with communities and the people who rely upon them. And I'm just wondering what you're saying about baselines and understanding what is a wild space or what is a damaged space, or, you know, what a space looks like. how do we, and for anyone really I'm asking this, is how those kind of ideas are communicated and how they can be effectively communicated in a kind of a sense that allows dialogue still to exist, you know, not imposing information on people, because it seems that it isn't a sort of black and white situation. So how can we kind of open up those dialogues and communities and between communities on the island?
It's showing, isn't it, Mark, rather than telling?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, COVID, dare I mention it, has reconnected people with their local spaces. People have looked on their own doorstep to see where they could go and enjoy some open space. And I think people have actually started to realise this little woodland they knew 10 years ago isn't the same as it was 10 years ago. Things have maybe not, they don't look as good anymore, or the river doesn't look as clean as it did as they remembered. So I think local awareness of the degradation of the environment is increasing. But we need people, as Shirley says, to have the opportunity to go and experience what a good, healthy environment looks like. And we are lucky enough on the island of Ireland to still have some pockets of pristine habitat. You know, you can go and see pockets of pristine oak woodland, ancient woodland, or you can go and see areas of clean rivers and good bogs and so on. But unfortunately, they're also starting to degrade, and we're beginning to lose those pristine habitats. So it goes back to what Una was saying about having a baseline of understanding what we have before we lose it. And I think part of communicating the importance of these environments to the community is to actually get them involved in this biodiversity recording. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing literally an army of citizen scientists emerging on the island of Ireland, taking their own interests and knowledge and becoming trained up so that they can go out and record all of this information and submit it to the National Biodiversity Data Centre or to CEDAR. And they're not just going out there and ticking boxes. Mm-hmm. They're actually upskilling themselves to become specialists mm-hmm. and identify key plants, key birds, key habitats in different environments. And we're not going to have the baseline that we need, or indeed the record of how the environment's changing, without the involvement of the wider community. So that has begun. But I think that the whole idea around citizen science needs to be better supported, particularly by government, because if we expect the community as a whole to help in the effort to record and help improve biodiversity and the environment, those groups of community members need to be supported in doing that. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they'll feel that they're trying to do all that they can, but their work isn't being taken seriously enough.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I wondered, it was kind of following on from that, you've been, I mean, engaging people in your work and engaging citizens in your work. I wondered if you've seen any positive changes that have come through that kind of engagement that you've been doing, and how they've kind of been demonstrated, and I guess the positive outlooks that you can see now coming from that work.
Yeah, you know, there's so many positives, and I know that we've been focusing a wee bit maybe on the declines, but there really are so many positives out there. And going back to the pollinator plan again, we wanted to make sure that we tracked whether or not that was working. So there's three ways that we do it. One is in actually having this, you know, all island strategy and implementing it. So the action's actually being delivered, and we've seen that happening. Where we've also seen really positive change is in the amount of engagement across all sectors. So, you know, at the minute, 86% of councils or local authorities have agreed, you know, to support the pollinator plan and make changes on the land that they manage. There are really hundreds of local communities, you know, through Tidy Towns in the Republic, and also, you know, through the various initiatives in Northern Ireland, who've really embraced it and are making genuine changes in their local communities to make them more biodiversity friendly. There's over 300 businesses, you know, who are becoming more pollinator friendly. So I guess across all sectors, we're seeing people making changes. And then, but that comes back to then the third way that you need to measure success, and that is in changes in biodiversity itself. So, you know, for within the pollinator plan, that is in positive changes, that is in seeing more bees within the landscape, you know, more bumblebees, more solitary bees. I suppose I get asked this all the time, you know, is it working? Are there more bumblebees than when you started, you know, in 2015? And the honest answer is that I don't know yet, and that we can't know yet, because you have to put the habitat back, which is what's happening. But then you have to give you know, the insects time to respond to that. So that's not something that we would expect to see until towards the end of this phase of the plan or maybe into the next. But what we are seeing, as Mark said, you know, a huge increase in the number of people engaging. So, you know, just since 2015 when we launched the plan, we've had a 300% increase in the number of people who are identifying wild bees and sending us records of them. You know, that's a huge increase. So people really are connecting a lot more. And sometimes it's easier to look at plants. We know there's a gorgeous little native plant in Ireland called the bee orchid, which ironically doesn't actually have to be pollinated by a bee, but it's a gorgeous little native wild flower. And you get it when you don't manage the landscape as much, basically. So when you don't spray as much and when you don't cut the grass as often. And what we've seen since, you know, we started encouraging people to make changes through the pollinator plan is a 250% increase in the number of bee orchids that are being reported. Now, you know, if people are seeing more bee orchids, there's also lots and lots of other less conspicuous wildflowers that are doing much, much better, all to the benefit of them, to the benefit of the insects, you know, the birds and the mammals that feed on the seeds and so on. So there's really positive change out there. We're definitely going in the right direction. But, you know, as I said, it is still a wee bit urgent. And if I can just make one point, I thought Shirley's point was really good and really interesting about shifting normals. And I think that is so important. You know, I often think when I was young growing up, you'd go out in the garden, you know, it was full of bumblebees. And I used to be scared to go outside the door at night when, you know, because it was dark and the light and there'd be so many moths flitting around it. And you'd be scared to go outside because there was so many of them. You know, whereas for my children, they don't have that. You know, their normal is very, very different. So they have no sense of what it is that we've lost. So I think we have to be really careful, you know, that we realize where we're at in this stage, that we are losing things. And that we often get told, oh, you need to target schools. And we say, yeah, of course we need to target schools. We need to empower young people. But we also have to leave something there for them to protect. You know, so we have to act now to make sure that we protect these things and leave them, you know, and protect them for those future generations.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think there's a lot of focus. I mean, that's often said to me, you know, oh, you should do more school projects. You should talk to the children, you know. And in a sense, you're putting all the pressure then on the future generation to go and do something about the thing that we have done. And, you know, so I would also say, well, we need to actually talk to the adults and talk to those people who are actually in power, which is one of the reasons why the All Ireland Pollinator Plan has worked quite well, is because it has actually focused on those different communities. You know, it's focused on sports clubs and even, you know, the local authorities to try to make local authorities put in place changes and local communities. But like, I find that working with groups, and I work primarily with adults, you know, I mean, we do run, you know, school programs, but we don't have the resources to implement them. So they're run through the Heritage Council, usually, you know, the Heritage Council and Schools program. But I would generally deal with groups of adults, you know, so community groups or groups of local councillors and, you know, local authority staff. And, you know, it has taken a long time for people to come round to the idea that biodiversity is in trouble. You know, because it up until now, it hadn't really been covered in the national media very much. You know, there was a survey done that showed that, you know, even in comparison to the climate crisis, which you would think was covered a lot, biodiversity was really down the pecking order when it came to coverage in the press and in the media. So when you consider how the climate activists were complaining about how little there was about climate, you can imagine how little there is about biodiversity. And you know, I always call biodiversity our life support system, because it provides so much of these services, the water, you know, crops, medicines, our food, fish, nursery habitat, you know, and habitats for wildlife. But it really is something we very much depend on. And I think we've lost that understanding of how actually the world works. Somehow we've become disenfranchised from the thing that gives us life and gives us livelihoods. And I would always try to have conversations with adults at that level, because I think people need to kind of get a little bit more of a grip on that and not just see biodiversity somewhere got confused with fluffy animals over there on TV that were very exotic. And I remember one time I did actually go to some schools with the wildlife program about 15 years ago. I asked all the kids, I said, you know, what's your favorite animal? And all of them said elephants, tigers, you know, whatever, rhinoceroses. And one little fella said a bull. You know, well, my favourite's a bull. You know, and I was like, okay, right, great. Not one of them mentioned anything native or anything in the wild or in the wilderness in Ireland. And it came back to me very much that even just then they weren't engaging with their local environment. Biodiversity was a thing far away. But then all of this citizen science that's been going on, all of this new work, you know, out there recording bees, butterflies, you know, bird species, plant species, looking at things closely, I think really has improved the connectivity that communities have with their landscape and their ecology. And they're starting to understand how that ecology is actually delivering benefits for them. And that's the real link that we need people to understand. And I think it was Mark who said custodian earlier on. And, you know, that whole idea that we were all brought up with, that we were very much in control of the environment. We were, you know, it was in our dominion, basically. And then custodians, stewards, but we're part of it. And I think the more citizen science you do and the more the groups do that, they start to get that. And that's an important realisation, isn't
it? Yeah, absolutely. And I think you've touched on something there about environmental education. And there's been a lot of focus on environmental education. And when we use the word education, we naturally think of children and young people. And it's more about environmental awareness that we should all have. And you're absolutely right. It shocks me when we go into schools as Rivers Trusts and we want to talk about the local rivers and the water wildlife, and what the children are learning about in school is the Amazon or the Nile. And there's nothing wrong with that, but they don't seem to make the connection that we have our own rivers here and our own problems that we need to address. But I just think that education needs to be widened out to bring in all aspects of society and everyone, you know, that can play a role in protecting the environment as a whole. And people do feel disengaged from it, that they don't see that they could make a difference themselves. And the example of the All Island Pollinator Plan is actually an excellent example of how you give people the tools and the knowledge that they need to be able to do something in their own garden or in the local park. So then when they take those small first steps, it encourages them and empowers them to be able to do bigger and better things. And more people start to come together to make a much bigger difference.
Yeah,
I think it's interesting what you said just now about the schools program and about the sort of favorite animal, because I read very recently about how in the past people would have perhaps, you know, children were perhaps learning more about wildlife and about biodiversity and landscape through directly engaging with it, whereas now a lot of the students who are applying to courses in biology or ecology are taking their inspiration from documentary films and books a lot more than they might have been in the past, which it was just something that I came across recently. But you're sort of talking about this environmental education and widening it out, not just among children but across the entire population. And I guess more and more people are becoming aware of the crisis that we're facing at the moment in terms of biodiversity. For people who are becoming aware of that and wanting to address it, but are perhaps feeling a bit disheartened by the kind of situations they're being faced with, by the kind of news that we're hearing. It's very often this kind of negative news of, you know, we're in this crisis, you know, we have such high levels of pollution, we have such high levels of, you know, we're talking about the next mass extinction in a lot of news stories. And you know, this can be really, really disheartening, and both for adults and for children who are kind of learning about these things. I guess how can this growing awareness be directed towards a kind of an energy that drives in the right direction, rather than people just feeling sort of down about the situation?
I've noticed a lot more people getting involved in group activities, you know, or coming on even awareness walks, but before the pandemic anyway, certainly, and they were certainly engaging online during the pandemic with environmental sort of awareness or education. But before that, like, I mean, I noticed a lot more people coming on bat walks, even, for example, or even dawn chorus walks, and, you know, walks on the bog to learn about the species, and engaging a lot more with the technical aspects, shall we say, of biodiversity, and really wanting, I think the word somebody used was upskill, upskill themselves so they could get involved more. And, you know, as heritage officers, we work with the local authority, but we also work with local communities a lot. So we try to set up networks and, you know, schemes on local wetlands. Like, so like we've just set up a County Monaghan Wetland Network, for example, where we're trying to facilitate groups to get involved with their local wetland to actually do something beneficial for it. Rather than just, you know, wanting it for their own recreation, but recognizing that they can do something benefit to help that. And I think that that's the kind of thing we need a lot more of. And it's actually participation and facilitating NGOs, I have to say, to have the resources on the all-island basis to help communities and deliver more work on the ground. You know, we need to collect information, we need citizen scientists, but we also need conservation, restoration works,
action.
And we need to support landowners, really do, with, you know, things that they can do that they can feel good about as a farmer, as a landowner, to build their confidence, build themselves within their peer network of farmers that's a good farmer. You know, that having wildlife on your farm is the sign of being a good farmer. It's not about everything being really neat and tidy and pristine, which is obviously important from a pollution point of view, but that we need to have habitats on farms. And we need farmers to be able to say, well, you know, I'm keeping this third of a hectare for woodland. I'm fencing back my wetland. You know, I'm getting involved in the Farming for Nature scheme. You know, that's you know, running in the Republic of Ireland. And I know they're trying to get ambassadors coming from Northern Ireland as well to participate in that, because the great thing about that scheme is that it is farmer to farmer. It's peer to peer, and very much like at a community level as well. You're working with people who have that shared interest. So they're community to community, or they're members of the same catchment. So obviously they have an interest, or they're the members of the same JAA club, you know, like this, or the sporting club, they're in a cricket club or whatever. And they're putting in place pollinator measures, you know, so they have another shared interest. And it's in that other shared interest they can then get involved in biodiversity. And they're not mutually exclusive then. It's not something else. You're not just a tree hugger. You're not somebody with binoculars only, you know. Yep. You're not the Birkenstock wearing, although we can all love a good pair of Birkenstocks, but we're not just the Birkenstock wearing, you know, tree hugger, I hold my hand up, you know, person, but we're also a rounded individual.
Yes.
That's involved in all of these other things that also looks after our environment, you know.
Yeah, but I think you've made a very good point about enabling NGOs and communities to embrace these things that we're asking them to do. And I see that one of the problems that we have, and I hate to bring it back to a problem, but it is actually a barrier, is that a lot of our approaches to environmental management is very short term. You know, there are pots of funding available to community groups and NGOs, but they may only be available for 12 months. Then you might be lucky that they're available for 3 years. It's very hard to make a change in the environment in a very short space of time. And what we need is proper support for communities to be able to get an initiative up and running, but then be able to still be doing that 5, 10, 15 years down the road, because we need to be invested in this in the long term. And I fear that, unfortunately, we don't have those structures in place yet to invest in that long term, you know, dedication to these environmental projects.
Is that a sort of a systemic issue that exists in the kind of support that does exist for NGOs engaged in biodiversity?
It's for everybody involved in the environmental biodiversity sector. The only real long term funding you can get is if you're involved in an EU project, actually. Yes. And, you know, that's maybe a 5-year project. But by the time you get everything set up, running, all your baselines done, you've only got about 2 years of action in it, haven't you?
And they're not really geared up, those types of projects, for projects at a community level.
They're too expensive.
And community groups, and I just want to make the point as well that I actually think we have a great awareness of the environment in Ireland. You know, that we're not wanting for people who want to go out and do something beneficial for the environment, but they come up against very kind of practical barriers to doing it. So, you know, Have they got insurance to be able to go out and do the activity they're going to do? Have they got, you know, all the right policies in place? I mean, you might call
health
these boring things, you know, but they are essential things, but they become barriers to communities wanting to go out and do it. Now, those barriers can be overcome where NGOs take on those responsibilities on their behalf. And I think Tidy Towns is a good example of that. We in the Rivers Trust are doing it for local Rivers Trusts. But until we get into a position where a community who is already invested in their environment is supported wholeheartedly to continue with the good work that we're doing, we're going to see this stop-start approach all the time to environmental management on the island of Ireland. And that we're not going to achieve what we want to achieve by doing it that way.
So true. And this is the decade of restoration
we're
in at the moment. And, you know, like, how are we going to do that? Have we actually thought on the all-island basis, how are we going to engage with the decade of restoration? You know, what are we going to do by 2030 for all of our habitats? And Mark's absolutely right. That stop-start cycle is wearing on the communities. It's wearing on the NGO sector. It's wearing on local authorities as well, because you try to get something started and, you know, you're going good-o at it. And then, you know, there's a break in funding or, you know, which just interrupts the whole thing. And we just need that long-term thinking. You know, it's applied to sporting clubs, for goodness sake.
Yes.
They can have a long-term approach. They can have a long-term vision. But you know, we can't. And, you know, It's just so difficult. And the way that Una has managed to get the All Island Pollinator Plan established in such a way with so limited resources, like, is pretty amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, would you mind kind of moving on from that, kind of looking at not only how you've overcome the kind of barriers that I guess Shirley and Mark are talking about, but also creating those huge collaborations across multiple sectors. And I mean, you're looking at then not just barriers within one sector, but perhaps within other areas and in other jurisdictions, and how you've kind of been able to overcome some of those.
Yeah, of course. I should say that it's really not just me. You know, there's an amazing steering group behind the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan, and also thanks to government funding this time, we've got three super project officers. But what we tried to do within the plan was to make sure that it was collaborative right from the very start. You know, so we made a decision, you know, was this going to be done as a plan for the Republic and a separate plan for Northern Ireland, or would we do one on an all-island basis? You know, collectively we decided that all-island was the way to go. So I saw that each step of the process, we've tried to ensure that we're doing it together. And as I said, you know, what we wanted to do was try to, it's all very well asking people to help on biodiversity or any other topic, unless you tell them what it is you're asking them to do. You know, so we brought together people and identified the sectors that could help, which essentially is everyone. Anyone who has any responsibility for a piece of land can make positive changes for biodiversity. So we identified all the sectors that could help. And then we looked at the science and identified the actions that were evidence-based. So, you know, if you take these actions for pollinators or biodiversity, it will have a positive impact. And then we tried to communicate that to the sector. You know, so for example, we did one for local communities. We identified all the actions that local communities could take to improve their local area for pollinators. We worked with local communities, and before we signed off essentially on that, we worked with communities both north and south of the border to make sure, you know, that the language was right, that it was inclusive, that it was going to make sense to everyone. And I suppose that's the kind of approach that we've taken. And each time we've done that, so we try to these evidence-based guidelines, but we tailor them. So, for example, you know, there's another one for faith communities. So the actions are very similar to the one for local communities, but obviously it's communicated in a different way, you know, for those faith community groups. So I think that's been very important in just opening it up to people. So, you know, it's a democracy, isn't it? People get involved or they don't as they wish. But what we wanted to do was to try and make it as easy as possible for as many people to get involved. And that's, I suppose, what we've done with these different guidelines. And that's, I think, you know, where we've seen the success. You know, so a local community group in Kerry can pick it up and know what to do in the same way that one, you know, in Derry or Antrim can do. And what we've tried to do then is to make sure that we share knowledge as much as possible, to try and identify, of course there are issues, there are challenges, but you know, it's about identifying those and then sharing the solutions. And that's, I suppose, where we've had a lot of success. And there's so many challenges, of course there are, but you know, maybe you know, there's amazing projects, for example, in the Northern Ireland, you know, the Causeway Coast and Glens District Council, this amazing Don't Mow, Let It Grow project that they initiated. You know, we've been able to take the learnings from that and then apply them across the whole island. So now there's very few local authorities, you know, that haven't reduced mowing and adopted this sort of Don't Mow, Let It Grow approach to enhancing biodiversity at local levels. So I suppose it's about telling people what to do. It's about making sure that what you're asking them to do is realistic and communicate in the right way to them. And that's about sharing knowledge and evolving and moving forward together to try and implement it.
Yeah. Mm. And I think, you know, the whole concept of the All Island Pollinator Plan is key to all of our environment. We need to stop thinking about our environment as something we manage in Northern Ireland and something we manage in the Republic of Ireland. We live on one biogeographical region of the island of Ireland, and we can't continue to manage things in two separate jurisdictions. We need to be managing them on an all-island basis. You know, the island of Ireland has some fantastic biodiversity, as Una said, and one example I might give you is the white-clawed crayfish, mm-hmm. which is a small, looks like a wee lobster that lives in our rivers. The island of Ireland is the last landmass in Europe to only have one species of crayfish living on it. All the rest of Europe, the white-clawed crayfish populations are being decimated by invasive species and diseases that those invasive species carry. The island of Ireland has become the last stronghold for white-clawed crayfish, not just in an Irish context, but in a whole European and global context. Mm-hmm. And if we are really going to save that species from extinction, we need to be working together in north and south of the border. There's no question about it. So it doesn't just end with pollinators or with white-clawed crayfish. It should be applied to every aspect of environmental management that we have to have a concern about. And we need to be working together to protect and improve our environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because even in Monaghan, the White Claw crayfish, you know, there's five little lakes in Clonus and Fermanagh, and the border goes right through the middle of some of those lakes.
That's right.
You know, and I've been on one side of those lakes, and people from Northern Ireland have been on the other doing a survey, you mm-hmm. know, right across, you know, the reed bed.
Yes.
You know, and the little, like, you know, it's under threat big time in those lakes in Monaghan and elsewhere. And, you know, we have to have an all-island vision for biodiversity on this island. You know, I mean, as Mark said, I love this island. You know, when I was a kid, we always went, you know, to Northern Ireland. We went to all the brilliant parks. We went around the coastline. We went to visit National Trust woodlands, you know, and we went further down south to look at places. And it was always, you know, something to recall in tough times that you had this amazing, you know, sense of biodiversity to rely on, that beautiful vision that you could think about, you know, and to think that our children won't have that, that we'll be living in an island that's depleted. Wouldn't that, we think just that would be such a really horrible thing to a legacy to leave them. Yeah. And, you know, what a fantastic positive thing it could be to build on the All Island Pollinator Plan, for example, to do that for lots of other biodiversity, and to really, the thing about the All Island Pollinator Plan is that it's so clear. Mm-hmm. It communicates yes. everything so clearly. It tells you what you can do, where you can do it, in from where you're coming from your own perspective. And I think, you know, we can do that for other types of habitats, for other issues, if we get the resources to work together.
And you made the point, Shirley, that about heritage, and it sounds like a very backward looking thing, but it's not. Our environment defines who we are.
Yes,
that's what you were saying. It's who we are. It's in us. Mm. It's part of us. So we need to all be asking ourselves here today, who do we want to be? Who do we want to be remembered as in the future? And
yes.
I think the vast majority of us would want to be seen as those that took care of the environment and improved it such that we handed it on to the next generation in a better state than the way we found it.
Are we good ancestors?
Yes, exactly.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, you've pointed out there that we are an island. And when you talk there about the white claw crayfish, you know, we have this unique kind of biogeography that we aren't necessarily, we don't have the same situation perhaps that, you know, a country on a continent may have. And we have that kind of enclosed environment in a sense.
Yes.
And it's something that we can kind of feel. You've mentioned earlier this kind of custodian role or guardianship role. And you've just asked the question, Shirley, are we good ancestors? And we can kind of look at that in this kind of context, which is really, you know, it's an image that we can perceive, that is tangible.
Yes.
You know, we can see the scale at which we're working at. We can see the environment that we're engaging with. And it is something that's all around us. You've mentioned cities, farmland. We've looked at sort of woodland areas and native woodland and hedgerows and peatlands. And these are all areas that somebody has in close proximity to them, and is something that they can engage with. So I've really enjoyed kind of hearing about that and about the ways that we can communicate those kind of ideas, but especially how we can collaborate on understanding the problems that we have across the island for biodiversity, whether it be in rivers or in peatlands or whether it be with a specific species or an entire ecosystem, and the ways that kind of, I guess, reflecting that connectivity that exists in biodiversity, that we kind of collaborate on the same kind of structure that I guess we're learning from that connectivity. So thank you very much to all of you, to Shirley and to Mark and to Una for joining us today. It's been a very enjoyable conversation and something I've learned a lot from. So thank you.
You have been listening to Across Divides. Learn more about today's topic and find opportunities to get involved at icommunityhub.org. iCommunity is a joint initiative of the Wheel and NICFA and is supported by the Northern Ireland Department for Communities, the Department of Foreign Affairs Reconciliation Fund, and the Shared Island Unit in the Department of the Taoiseach.